Money Movers provides investors with real-time analysis of the stories and the people attracting the attention of markets each day. I'm Carl Quintanilla.
And I'm Sarah Eisen. We'll cover the breaking news and numbers driving stocks and sectors, helping you make critical decisions. Plus, we'll speak with the CEOs, newsmakers, and political leaders playing a role in how your money is moving.
Listen to CNBC's Money Movers free on the Odyssey app.
It is delightful outside. If you have not been outside, man, you're going to be pleasantly surprised. 55 degrees and windy. It's that first cool day of the year that we all wait for, and finally it's here. Tomorrow, highs of 79. Kind of cool tonight. Lows around 59, 60 degrees. Then tomorrow, I got ahead of myself here, 69 for a high today, 73 tomorrow. Tim, it's going to be cool and nice. Let's just leave it at that. Libby Saunier joins us now, Executive Director of Louisiana Policy Institute for Children. Good morning, Libby. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. Thank you.
You know, if I'd had better early childhood education, perhaps I wouldn't have butchered the weather like I just did. What do you think?
Perhaps.
Yeah. Tell me about the importance of early childhood education before we talk about budget cuts, if you would, please.
Sure. So what we know fundamentally is that 90% of brain development happens before the age of five. And so these early years are critically important. What we also know is that creating access to quality early care and education really does help parents be able to stay in the workforce and or go to school.
How has this changed, Libby, in the state of Louisiana through the years, just maybe going back a decade or two? And I ask that because I think there are proven results, are there not?
Absolutely. So what we've seen over the last, decade really is that when we have increased investments in early care and education, our children tend to do better in school, particularly if we looked at the longitudinal work by the Council for a Better Louisiana with our LA4, which is our four-year-old program in the state. So for young children that have access to quality early care and education the first 5 years of life, they're more prone to finish high school, read on grade level, participate in the workforce, and have better life outcomes as they age.
So I should say, Dr. Libby Saunier, if everything's working so well, why would we fool with it?
I mean, I don't think we should fool with it. I think that we need increased investment in access to quality early care and education, particularly if you look at our labor participation rate. We know that a major barrier for families is finding affordable, quality early care and education so that they can be in the workforce. And so, we're hopeful that we can continue to make the case for why quality early care and education is important, not just for school readiness, but also for parents to be able to stay in the workforce.
Maybe I phrased that question kind of awkwardly. I guess what I meant to ask is, what is at risk now with the so-called fiscal cliff, budget, maybe tax reform, sales tax dropping off? How concerned are you that something will change?
I think we're fairly concerned that we could see a reduction in the child care assistance program in our state with state dollars. And that would be concerning because that would mean that families wouldn't have access to quality early care and education and they wouldn't be able to go to work. And that's a problem. And we want to make sure that, we can keep families working in Louisiana and make sure that our young children enter into kindergarten ready to learn. Because currently, right now, 70% of kindergartners are entering in kindergarten in Louisiana that they're already behind. And once children start behind, they tend to stay behind. So we want to make sure we're keeping these little people in quality early care and education, and we're keeping families working.
Let me drill down a little bit on the importance of reading at level, I guess, when you get to the third grade. We have a big problem in Louisiana with that, do we not?
We do. I mean, I will say that Superintendent Brumley at the Louisiana Department of Education has really galvanized about the science of reading and making sure that children are able to read on grade level. And part of that process is making sure and ensuring that children have access during those first 5 years of life to quality early care and education.
And as you said earlier, I know you are an educator, that once a child gets in that hole, it's hard to pull out of that, isn't it?
It is. It's once you start behind, you stay behind. And, the schools are not meant to catch children up. by two or three grade levels. And so we want to make sure that we're starting young children on the right trajectory. We only have one right way to get it right the first time. And so ensuring that children are entering into kindergarten ready to learn so that they can read on grade level by third grade, do well in middle school, finish high school, go on to post-secondary, and be in the workforce. And then for those parents that are in the workforce now, that they can stay in the workforce because they have access to quality early care and education.
You know, I have a 28-year-old that's a teacher, and I hear stories about third graders that, you know, have a hard time with just the basics of things that a kindergartner should know. And this third grade, and you got to wonder how they got promoted to that level. So how does that happen? How does a child go, and how does a third grade teacher wind up getting a kid that can't read, barely knows numbers, et cetera?
Well, and I think that's, again, like a real focus of the Department of Education here in Louisiana is focusing on the fundamentals of reading and numeracy. Because at the end of the day, we've got to be in a place that we're not passing kids on, that we're ensuring that our children have the tools that they need to be successful in school and in life. And so that really starts, I would say, prenatally, but particularly in those first 5 years of life, to make sure that we have enough, as many children as we can, have access to quality early care and education. If we look at the rates right now, less than 30% of children that are at risk in our state, birth to three, have access to quality early care and education. We've got to make that number better so that we can make sure that children are entering into kindergarten ready to learn and they're able to read on grade level at third grade.
I want to talk about the economic benefits when we come back. Also, I don't know, you know, you got to hold the teachers accountable, but I don't know what a third grade teacher is supposed to do when they get a kid that's passed on to them that can't read. Because you say once you're behind, you stay behind. It's not the school's job to bring them up. So what happened? And for people, I think, Dr. Sonnier, that are not involved with this or not had somebody that's involved with it, they don't quite understand the extent of the problem. So you got a third grade teacher gets a kid that can't read, is numeral, how do you say it, illiterate, doesn't know their numbers? How would you phrase that?
The numeracy, I think, you know, fundamentally is what schools do is they do catch up children. They focus on intervention to ensure that we're catching these kids up as much as we can. But inevitably, there still are going to be some gaps for children that don't get caught up. And so that's really the focus of making sure that young children have access to quality early care and education in those first 5 years of life, so that when children get into the K-12 system, that those K-12 teachers are able to have the art of teaching and make sure that children are having what they need to be successful in school and in life.
But the fact is, if that third grader can't read, or a couple of third graders can't read, or half the third grade class can't read, or a third, that teacher's going to have to, and the assistants are going to have to devote more time with them, catching them up, which detracts from what
Absolutely.
They can spend to the other kids. So it has an overall effect.
Absolutely, it does. It absolutely does. And I think that, again, you know, the K-12 world is not my bailiwick and where I spend my time, but I really have to give a kudos to our Department of Education on the focus related to literacy and numeracy in the state to ensure that kids that are behind, that we're trying to catch them up the best that we can, and we're doing it based on the science of how young children learn and how they acquire literacy and numeracy skills.
All right, let's talk about the economics of this. We come back. Dr. Libby Sonnier, our guest, Executive Director of Louisiana Policy Institute for Children. I want to talk about like a scale. I don't know if there's a sliding scale or not about what kind of cuts it would have to take to make a big difference, and if there's any synergy involved, the more money you get, the better the results magnified. 722 traffic now.
This is the secret story of a young Russian oligarch who hacked his way to a $93 million fortune. I'm CNBC senior Washington correspondent Eamon Javers. In our new podcast, The Crimes of Putin's Traitor, I'll take you inside a shocking Russian crime targeting the American financial system. Attacks that sources tell me were welcomed by Vladimir Putin's government. Listen to CNBC's The Crimes of Putin's Traitor free on the Odyssey app.
Be well. 727 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Dr. Libby Sonnier, Executive Director of Louisiana Policy Institute for Children, talking about looming, I guess, Doctor, that'd be accurate, looming cuts to early childhood education. Has your organization been brought into this, and are they listening to what you have to say about the importance of getting kids ready from before they get to kindergarten?
I would say they're potential cuts. Nothing is written in stone yet. And so that leaves us in a spot of continuing to make the case for, you know, increased investment or just maintaining investments that we have in the state in quality early care and education. We just did a release last week with the state chamber, with the Louisiana Association for Business and Industry, related to a early childhood commission report being released. And Will Green, you know, from LAHBI, is really clear that for many Louisianians, a lack of access to affordable, high quality early care and education is a significant barrier to entering and remaining in the workforce. And so when we know these types of things from our business leaders, it's really hard to stomach that there could be potentially cuts to early care and education, because we know that our families need them.
And that's what I wanted to drill down on in a minute that we have remaining. Even if you don't have a kid that's before pre-kindergarten education, the availability of that is important to you as a business owner or just as a resident of Louisiana, right?
It absolutely is. It affects all of us. You know, if our labor participation rates don't increase, we're not going to have Louisianians working. And we know that we need them to. And we know that families fundamentally need to work to take care of their families and to be able to care for their children. And so ensuring that families are able to go to work is increasingly important to our workforce development and our economic development. And we're hearing that from chambers across the state and economic developers across the state. I mean, if you want to get somebody rolling on the importance of access to quality early care and education, Michael Heck can give you a heck of a spiel, because he knows that that's how we're going to be able to recruit and retain talent in our state.
Oh, Michael Heck can give you a heck of a spiel on anything. I'm just kidding. Thank you, Dr.
Sonia.
He is.
He's fantastic.
He is. Thank you. I appreciate your time. It just seems like of everything that could potentially be cut, this would be the thing on the bottom of the list, because it gives you the most bang for your buck. Accurate?
Exactly. For every dollar that we spend on quality early care and education, we can get a 13% return on investment. Why wouldn't we invest in our children and in our families?
That's hard to find, a 13% return. Thank you, Dr. Sonia. We'll talk to you again soon. When we come back, we'll talk about why politically charged content gets more engagement on social media. Right now, time for WWL First News. We are in for a beautiful stretch of weather. If you're, maybe I should shout, because you might be driving around with the windows roll down. I say we're in for a stretch of beautiful weather. Highs today of 72, lows tonight in the 50s, then 69 for a high tomorrow, 73, 75 Friday and Saturday. Sunday is going to be great. Highs of 77 and really in the 70s through next Monday. And as you go to the Dome tomorrow night for the Saints-Broncos game, let that cool weather get you fired up and really support them, because now's the time they need you. Not when they're going to the playoffs or when they're in the NFC Championship game. Now's the time they really need the crowd behind them. Daniel Moshon joins us right now, Associate Professor of Marketing at the A.B. Freeman School of Business at Tulane. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Is it Moshon? Did I say that right?
That is right, yeah.
Okay. We're going to talk about this study, a new Tulane University study that explains why politically charged content gets more engagement on social media. And let me ask the audience here at 504-260-1870. I know they call it doom scrolling, but do you anger scroll? Does the audience, do you go through things that you find just waiting to get you angry and then you respond to them? Show me what your study showed, Professor.
So in our research, we examined a pattern that we named the confrontation effect. And this effect is the tendency of online users to engage more with content they disagree with than with content they agree with, especially for highly charged topics like political beliefs. And we find that this effect is mainly due to the outrage that people feel in response to belief-challenging content, which motivates them to confront and fight back against it. So in other words, we see things that we disagree with, it makes us angry. That anger makes us want to fight back and essentially attack the source of the anger. And we label this entire pattern the confrontation effect.
So you're more inclined to respond to something that you disagree with than agree?
Yes, for highly charged topics. We don't see this effect for things people don't care that much about. Mm-hmm. Like if you're debating, you know, what brand of phone you want or something like that. But for really core values, like our political beliefs, our religious beliefs, that kind of stuff. You know, people get really upset when they see something that goes against their beliefs, and that just encourages them to essentially engage and fight back against it.
Yeah, the first thing I thought of is that people, when I saw this, that people are more inclined to either call a manager over if they're not happy, or write a letter, or go on media and post a negative review about something if they're angry, then they are a positive thing. Does that have anything to do with this at all?
Well, I think in general, outrage is a very strongly motivating emotion, and I think we see the effect of outrage in different settings. So in consumer settings, for sure, if we have a very bad experience and a company makes us upset, that motivates us to go and complain to a manager or post online. You know, the source of the outrage is a little bit different, but I think the motivation is quite similar in these settings.
When it comes to facts entering into this, or truth entering into this, which in this day and age is incredibly hard to find, and I don't know that, you know, now we get philosophical, Professor, right, with what is absolute truth, and there are so many nuances and so many complexities involved with what some people perceive to be simple problems. There are no simple solutions to complex problems. Does that matter in this, or is it just all emotion, or was the study able to determine any of this?
So in our study, we didn't see very much on facts. What we saw is a lot of people just getting upset and kind of yelling back. But I think in the broader question of facts online is a really important one, because, as you said, there's a lot of misinformation online, and it's important to, you know, help people better process and better engage with information. And I think that's the bigger question we're interested in understanding. How do we get people to engage in a positive, productive way with information online, especially in for topics that are important for our country, but that people struggle to look at what the other side is talking about?
I like the difference here between sports or fashion reflecting interest and political engagement stemming from anger, causing a vicious cycle. Talk about that, if you would.
Yes, so there's a lot of research on showing that things that challenge our core values create a much larger degree of outrage than other topics that, you know, we have beliefs about, but they aren't really core to ourselves. Like, you know, I might prefer Nike over Reebok or Reebok over Nike, but if someone tells me that Nike is not a good sneaker, it's not something that's going to outrage me, because it's just not a core part of who I am. But if someone starts talking about, you know, political parties or, you know, very deeply held beliefs, then that is the kind of stuff that people get upset about and can lead to this type of effect.
The other thing I thought of when I read this is, you know, how many times have you had a discussion with somebody where you said, "Are you trying to make me mad?" And I realized that, yes, that's exactly what they're trying to do, is make you mad. And we'll talk about the reasons for that when we come back with Daniel Moshon, an executive associate professor of marketing at the A.B. Freeman School of Business at Tulane. New Tulane University study explains why politically charged content gets more engagement on social media. And yes, they are trying to get you mad. And we'll talk about why when we come back. 7:50, 10 till 8, Traffic Now, WWL. 7:56, 4 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Dr. Daniel Moshon, associate professor of marketing at the prestigious A.B. Freeman School of Business at Tulane. New study explains why politically charged content gets more engagement on social media. And, Professor, I was saying earlier, you know, like when you have an argument with somebody and they say, "Are you trying to get me mad?" That's kind of what they're trying to do. And it leads to a cycle that's based on algorithms, and we're being manipulated. Explain that, if you would, please.
Well, the way most online platforms work is that they look at people's engagement to try to figure out what type of content they want to show them. And in most cases, that's actually a pretty good rule to follow. If I engage with posts about fashion, I probably care about fashion. If I engage with posts about sports, I probably care about sports. The problem comes into the domain of politics, or other, you know, core beliefs that we have, where the type of content that we engage with isn't necessarily a good reflection of what we want to, you know, see more of. Our research shows that when we see things we disagree with, it makes us angry. That makes us engage with it. And because of the way these algorithms work, it's just going to lead to being fed more of this anger-inducing content. And so it sort of creates this vicious cycle where I'm shown stuff I don't like, I get angry, I engage with it out of anger, and then it shows me more of it, and I get caught in this vicious negative cycle of anger and engagement.
With an eye toward what? Who's generating the content, and what is the ultimate goal here?
Well, I mean, I think there are many parties involved. The platforms themselves, like the social media networks, their goal is just to keep you on the network. You know, the longer, the more time you spend there, the more ads they can show you, and so the more money they can make. And so whatever keeps you engaged, whether it's positive or negative, the more they'll show you of it. You know, as for the parties trying to induce outrage, well, outrage is very motivating. And so if I'm working in politics and I'm trying to get my base riled up, you know, outrage is a good way to do so. And so I think it's being used as a tactic to get people motivated and take action. But at the same time, it's not necessarily great for the users or for society in general to have everyone in a constant state of outrage.
That was my next question, because it's outrage for outrage's sake, and that can't have good effects throughout society, right? In the real world, when you get off of social media and then try, does that, I guess the question, Doctor, is does it transfer from social media into people's everyday lives and interactions?
I think so. I mean, over the past few years and decades, we've seen a big rise in political polarization. You know, people are talking less and less to those across the political aisle. And there are many factors behind that, but I would guess that social media and this outrage machine is in part contributing to people not being able to engage anymore in a positive way with those they disagree with or those who have different opinions than theirs.
Hence, are you trying to get me mad? Thank you, Doctor. I appreciate your time. Dr. Daniel Moshon, Associate Professor of Marketing at the A.B. Freeman School of Business at Tulane. It can also lead to nut jobs saying they're going out to hunt FEMA workers in North Carolina, which doesn't help anything. And I realize he's an isolated nut job. I get that, but still. We'll talk to Ronald Serpas. We come back, Professor of Practice, Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD chief. We'll talk about crime and policing in New Orleans. Then we're going to talk about electric vehicles. A lot coming up. Stay with us.
You got to take a listen to this. It's Squawk Pod.
That's right. CNBC's flagship business news show is a podcast, Squawk Pod.
This is CNBC Control 2.
It is not just the show, folks.
It might be even better because it's only audio.
Join me, Katie Kramer, as I take you inside the Squawk Box control room and beyond the headlines of our TV broadcast with Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin every weekday.
Roll alpha.
Listen to CNBC's Squawk Pod free on the Odyssey app.